Too many people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 10 and 11, March 7th and 14th, 2011. False flag warning. U.S. ships in waters around Mideast are sitting ducks for war-provoking act. By Dave Gahary. If neoconservative Israel First wonks in the Obama administration have their way, the U.S. will open a third war front against Iran using a successful strategy that has launched four previous wars. Iran's ongoing refusal to fully cooperate with the Vienna-based International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, has been well covered by the mainstream media. Now, portions of an IAEA report made public recently claim Tehran is still in the market for nuclear missiles. Such a disclosure could increase the odds of a USS Liberty-style false flag attack on elements of the American Navy's Fifth Fleet. As most AFP readers are aware, Israel tried to sink the Liberty on June 8, 1967, while the vessel was in international waters electronically monitoring the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. Naval false flag attacks are quite common in U.S. history when American politicians itch for war. The USS Maine suffered a still-unsolved explosion in Havana Harbor in 1898. This event was used as a pretext for the Spanish-American War. The sinking of the Lusitania in 1915, ostensibly by the Germans, was used in Allied propaganda to whet the public's appetite for hostilities, giving the U.S. a reason to enter the Great War. President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill were fully aware of Japan's intent to bomb Pearl Harbor, opening the door for our entrance into World War II. Finally, the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident was used by Johnson administration hawks to open up America's disastrous involvement in the Vietnam War. The National Security Agency later admitted in a 2005 declassified study, no attack happened that night. The Fifth Fleet, consisting of a carrier strike group, amphibious ready group or expeditionary strike group, surface combatants, submarines, maritime patrol, and reconnaissance aircraft, and logistics ships run by nearly 15,000 personnel, patrols the Persian Gulf, Red Sea, Arabian Sea, and the East African coast near Kenya. Although a formidable presence in that ever-unstable region, the Fifth Fleet is vulnerable to destruction by older, less sophisticated Iranian weaponry, as Millennium Challenge 2002, the largest wargame exercise in history, revealed. A major participant resigned while the exercise was ongoing, citing the obsession by civilian bureaucrats that the U.S. military could not and would not be defeated. In light of that wargame's results, a more cynical observer could argue that the Fifth Fleet is purposely being put in harm's way. The book, Ship Without a Country, Eyewitness Accounts of the Attack on the USS Liberty, 96 pages, softcover, $15, is available from AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003, or call 1-888-699-6397 toll-free and charge to a major credit card. Big event to honor Jim Tucker planned for D.C. on April 9th. There's no better time to visit the nation's capital than during the famous National Cherry Blossom Festival, held every year in early April. Coincidentally, this is also the weekend that the globalists at the Trilateral Commission have chosen to gather in Washington, D.C., in order to discuss how to further exploit their contrived economic crisis. AFP's Jim Tucker will be there as well, bird-dogging the global bankers in order to expose their machinations. Jim has devoted more than a quarter century to pursuing the elites, and it's no exaggeration to say that few people in the world have done more to uncover the nefarious plans of the Bilderbergers and the Trilateralists than Jim has. So please join us April 9th at the Capitol Hill Skyline Hotel when we present Jim with a Lifetime Achievement Award for all of his hard work. As this edition goes to press, we are in the process of nailing down the details of the event. Please call Pete at 202-544-5977 if you would like to attend. Page 2, personal from the editor. A tribute to Jim Tucker. We're glad to announce the first ever tribute to AFP editor emeritus Jim Tucker, slated to take place on Saturday, April 9th, at the Capitol Skyline Hotel, just south of the Capitol Building here in Washington. We encourage all interested persons to attend and help us honor Jim with witticisms and good memories in the freedom fight. I've been asked to speak at the affair along with several others who are expected to pay tribute to Jim's life work over the years as well as jab him with some good humor, likely to include Victor Thorne, Pete Papa Heracles, Michael Collins Piper, Willis Cardo, Chris Petherick, Julia Foster, and others. The exact roster is being finalized, but this is guaranteed to be an event to remember. We'll soon publish specifics on whether light fare will be included and what the moderate attendance cost will be. Call Pete or Julia right away at 202-544-5977 and let us know whether you will attend. And if you would like to make a donation in support of Jim's work exposing the scheming of the globalists like David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger, please do so. We cannot do this alone, and we sincerely appreciate everything you do to aid us in our fight. Jim deserves this event to accent a career that goes back a half century. Jim has earned an especially long and impressive track record, the best among alternative media reporters. His work has been documented in his own book, Jim Tucker's Bilderberg Diary. So come one, come all to help us honor the world's most seasoned and professional Bilderberg / trilateral hound. We look forward to your attendance. Please watch closely for an emergency letter from AFP's editors that was sent out in the mail to our readers during our President's Day break. It emphasizes what our front page story this week by Dave Gahary points out, that the time is ripe for a false flag attack as a tried and true tactic to push America into yet another war. As Gahary notes, all it would take is for a U.S. naval ship to be attacked by an unknown vessel or airplane flying an Iranian flag. Gahary cites plenty of historical examples of this trickery. However, the emergency letter also looks at the brighter side. Across the Mideast, the people are rising up against their kings and presidents to strive for freedom. They are dog-tired of being robbed blind by banker-backed tyrants. Moreover, see page 14 for hot news on Afghan kids yearning for freedom. A former ambassador lays out the sobering facts on that war-torn nation. All the best. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. TSA probes our sexual assaults. WMUR Television News in New Hampshire reports that the state's legislature is mulling a bill, HB 628-FN, that would criminalize certain Transportation Security Administration, TSA, screening procedures. According to the text of the measure, the proposed law makes the touching or viewing with a technological device of a person's breasts or genitals by a government security agent without probable cause a sexual assault. DNA scans. Not just intent on groping and taking naked pictures of you. The TSA wants its security guards to be able to scan and analyze your DNA on the spot with recently developed portable DNA fast scanning equipment, and then store the information in a secret government database. TSA is reportedly already testing the equipment, without even finding out if it violates our constitutional rights. Trains, too? TSA agents at a Savannah, Georgia Amtrak station have been screening passengers coming off trains in designated areas, according to a TSA website. News accounts also say some passengers coming off Greyhound buses also have been searched. We may be coming to a situation where an automobile is the best way to travel, but remember those checkpoints. Elephants lining up. The 2012 elections are still 2 years away, but already many Republicans are jockeying for position to take on President Obama. Representative Charlie Bass, Republican New Hampshire, told the Capitol Hill Daily that almost all of the rumored Republican presidential contenders have contacted him personally asking for his support in the next presidential election. In an ongoing series, AFP has been profiling many of the presumed candidates. Top oil producers. Readers may be surprised to learn that the number one oil producer is Russia, which averages 9.5 million barrels every day. The other top producers are Saudi Arabia, 8.3 million barrels daily, the United States, 5.4 million barrels daily, Iran, 4 million barrels daily, China, 3.8 million barrels daily, Mexico, 2.6 million barrels daily, Canada, 2.6 million barrels daily, United Arab Emirates, 2.4 million barrels daily, Iraq, 2.4 million barrels daily, and Kuwait, 2.4 million barrels daily. Big Brother spying. Mike German, who was fired by the FBI for speaking out against the growing police state, says U.S. law enforcement does specifically target Americans based on their political beliefs and ethnicity. During a recent interview with a national newspaper, German said, "Domestic spying is now being done by a host of federal agencies, FBI, DOD, DHS, DNI, as well as state and local law enforcement and even private companies. Too often, this spying targets political activity and religious practices. We've documented intelligence activities in 33 states and D.C. Perhaps Mr. German doesn't know the ADL bragged about its close relationship with FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover. Lights out for Edison. Americans have started hoarding incandescent light bulbs ahead of a government ban that mandates the exclusive sale of fluorescent bulbs in the coming years. The 2007 bill, which was signed into law by President George W. Bush, states that manufacturers will no longer be able to make the 100-watt Thomas Edison bulb after January 1, 2012, followed by the 75-watt version in 2013 and the 60 and 40-watt bulbs in January 2014. You'd expect riots. Testifying before Parliament recently, Mervyn King, the head of England's central bank, said, "The people whose jobs were destroyed were in no way responsible for the excesses of the financial sector and the crisis that followed. They are not getting bonuses on the scale of people in the financial sector, and they are the ones paying the price. Now is the period when the cost is being paid, and I'm surprised that the degree of anger hasn't been greater than it has." Farrakhan's non-interventionism. If you allow the Zionists to push you to mount a military offensive against Gaddafi, and you go in and kill him and his sons as you did with Saddam Hussein and his sons, I'm warning you, this is a Libyan problem. Let the Libyans solve their problems among themselves, Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan said recently. Shoppers dump credit cards, use cash. More Americans than ever are going back to using cash instead of credit cards, voting with their wallets to reject debt and the exorbitant fees imposed by financial companies, reports Sue Stock for McClatchy Newspapers. Those interviewed say it's one of the best ways to control spending and save money. Christy West told the newspaper she is moving her whole family to a cash-only system for almost all of the purchases they will be making this year. When you slide that debit card, it's teaching your mind to go from the tangible to the intangible, she said. But with cash, when the money's gone, it's gone. Page 4, high-level crime and corruption. Botched BATFE sting sends guns to drug cartels, by Pat Shannon. A federal indictment unsealed January 25th in the U.S. District Court in Arizona, coupled with private testimony from federal agents, reveals the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, BATFE, apparently has shot itself in the foot again. Perhaps Americans need to consider whether to close down an agency that played a major role in the killing of men, women, and children at the Branch Davidian Church in Waco, Texas in 1993. A BATFE operation in Arizona called Project Gunrunner, allegedly designed to curtail the availability of guns flowing across the border into the hands of Mexico's drug cartels, may be what resulted in the death of young Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, a Michigan native who was apparently killed by American guns intentionally allowed into the hands of known drug runners. Terry was featured in AFP's January 24, 2011 edition when Arizona State Senator Russell Pierce defended the state's embattled immigration law. American Free Press reviewed a copy of the 44-page indictment that names 20 defendants. The document shows that during the period from September 2009 through mid-December 2010, the BATFE became aware of suspicious buys at several gun stores in Phoenix and the surrounding metropolitan area. The cash sales, money sometimes placed on the counter in paper bags, alerted several shop owners to report the suspicious activity, but the authorities told them to allow the purchases to continue. Over the next 15 months, the BATFE continued to allow more than 2,500 questionable purchases, including 575 AK-47 semi-automatic rifles by people known to be passing the weapons on to the cartels across the border. Some agents were fearful and irate at what they considered to be a foolish decision made by higher-ups to allow the weapons on the streets in order to gather intelligence and trace where the guns were going. These agents have remained anonymous, fearing demotion or job loss. Agents were quoted by CBS News as saying that they were fully aware as they tracked the weapons that even the fearsome 50-caliber Barrett rifles were moving across the border and that eventually such weapons might be used against them. "The strategy was insane," one agent told CBS, telling of another frustrated agent overheard at BATFE radios pleading to intercede and arrest the weapons transport drivers, but they were always ordered to stand down. Another told of an office shouting match by agents and managers over the dangerous tactic of intentionally letting these guns walk into the wrong hands. One warned, "This is crazy and somebody's going to get killed." On December 14, 2010, the inevitable happened. A BATFE Special Tactical Border Squad was patrolling a known smuggling route south of Tucson near the Mexican border when a firefight broke out, and Agent Terry was shot and killed. Although the BATFE is in denial mode, national media sources say a serial number check showed that two rifles found at the scene matched a Phoenix gun buy that had been watched and recorded by BATFE agents months earlier. However, the indictment itself makes no mention of the shooting incident, and no one has been charged with the murder. It does allege that the defendants in various instances acted as if they were purchasing firearms for themselves, but in fact were purchasing them for others, with money derived from the illegal distribution of controlled substances, drugs. The weapons were transferred to other members of the conspiracy to be stored, sold, and transported, and there was a ready market among the drug trafficking organizations in Mexico and the United States, the indictment alleges, adding that the weapons were transported to Mexico. The Justice Department, which oversees the BATFE, has repeatedly denied that the agency has ever knowingly allowed the sale of weapons to suspected gunrunners. However, one of its own cases that AFP is tracking demonstrates that a similar Texas operation has been going on the same time as Arizona's. Grand Larceny, Latest Crime on Long List of TSA Abuses, by Peter Papaheraklis. In light of the need for deep budget cuts, it's time to consider eliminating the criminally arrogant Transportation Security Administration, TSA. Let's face it, the main purpose the TSA serves is myth management. Its mere presence helps perpetuate the greatest of all lies, that 19 Muslim terrorists equipped with box cutters hijacked four planes and caused the horrors of September 11, 2001. But the TSA is doing more than scanning for box cutters, tweezers, nail files, and other dangers. Two TSA officials were busted at New York's Kennedy Airport on February 16th for stealing a total of $160,000 in cash from luggage that they had handled. Devon Webb, 30, and Kuman Parad, 36, both black, were ratted out by colleagues after stealing $39,000 from one passenger's bag. After being interrogated, they confessed to the thefts. Parad is a 9-year employee, while his partner has worked for the TSA for about 7 years. The New York Post noted that they were expected to be charged with grand larceny, possession of stolen property, and official misconduct. Some of the money was found in their residences. Their operation involved one of them marking bags discovered via x-ray devices to contain cash, while the other would open these bags at the luggage area and remove the money. A TSA spokeswoman said that the two men will soon be fired. She told local media that their disgraceful actions are an exception to the otherwise exemplary behavior of TSA officials. But just 2 days earlier, Michael Arado, a TSA supervisor at Newark, New Jersey International Airport, pleaded guilty to stealing tens of thousands of dollars from passengers while screening their bags with the help of an accomplice. Less than a month earlier, a TSA employee was arrested in Memphis, Tennessee, for attempting to steal a passenger's laptop computer from a screening area. TSA's criminal behavior, coupled with its arrogance and invasive methods, is fast making it the most hated group in the United States, surpassing even lawyers. At first it was delays caused to passengers and the humiliating partial strip down they had to endure, as if they might take the jet down with concealed box cutters. Then all liquids, more than 3 ounces, were confiscated so that a miracle bomb couldn't be concocted in the bathroom. Recently, the absurdity and humiliation has reached new heights as passengers have had their privates patted down or undergone embarrassing body scans by extravagant Rapiscan brand machines, which have earned untold millions for former Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, who has a share in Rapiscan, just to prove that they are not underwear bombers. Now the TSA has upped the ante by robbing passengers. Page 6, AFP across the nation. Americans increasingly concerned about sovereignty. Secretive Trilateral Commission plans April policy meeting in Washington, D.C. by James P. Tucker, Jr. The Bilderberg Group will continue to try to profit from blood and hunger when the Group of 20, G20, and the Trilateral Commission meet in Washington, D.C., April 8th to the 11th. The two groups traditionally meet in the same city at the same time, so orders are conveniently transmitted. They recognize that patriotic Americans, those nasty nationalists, strongly oppose globalization and war for profit, but are trying to make the case that America is constantly under threat. It appears they will sustain the recession that some call a depression into 2012, so that jobs created by manufacturing war machines seem more acceptable. This clearly emerged in the ringing words of participants at a warm-up meeting of G20 finance ministers and international moguls in Paris in late February. Protecting Israel might require a military strike on Iran's nuclear program, Michael Mandelbaum wrote in the Bilderberg-controlled Washington Post on February 20th. A war with Iran, like all wars, would be a decidedly perilous undertaking, but this administration may ultimately decide that any alternative policy would be even more perilous. Continued American influence in the Middle East is crucial. Mandelbaum is a Bilderberg trilateralist mouthpiece and a professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. In Washington, William Kristol, editor of the neocon The Weekly Standard, joined in the Israeli cheerleading. He called for the use of force to protect Israel's interests in the Mideast. It means a full-scale engagement of the U.S. government and across-the-board effort with allies and international organizations. In Paris, calls for creating a World Treasury Department under the United Nations, a long-sought Bilderberg goal, were shrill if cautious, including from U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. We must do something to protect the global economy and have some international control, he said. There is plenty of debate about how to solve global challenges in a multipolar, interdependent world, said Lawrence Chandy of the Brookings Institution, which is a public relations arm of Bilderberg Trilateral Commission. Brookings annually publishes white papers supporting Bilderberg Trilateral Commission goals, and several Brookings members participate in Bilderberg and Trilateral Commission meetings. The rise of the developing world quite rightly shapes our understanding of investment opportunities, the balance of military power, global government, and more, Chandy added. But the international financiers glumly looked at new polls conducted by their own Washington Post, showing that most Americans are overwhelmingly nationalists who would never knowingly surrender sovereignty to a world government. In 2001, the poll showed 60% of Americans were amenable to a world government. As public education increased through American Free Press and other nationalist journals, attitudes changed. In 2003, only 42% would accept global government. That figure fell to 36% this year and continues to decline. And that is good news for you, and bad news for the global elite. Annual Freedom Conference stresses eternal vigilance by Victor Thorne. At Freedom Law School's 2011 Freedom Conference in Ontario, California, hosted by school founder Payman Motadeh, February 18th to the 21st, attendees heard more than a dozen speakers reiterate the need for citizens to remain vigilant during these turbulent times. Michael Badnarik, a 2004 Libertarian Party presidential candidate, told this writer, "Our life, liberty, and prosperity are in jeopardy. If we're not willing to fight for these rights, we're going to lose them." Last man out of the Twin Towers, William Rodriguez, who worked as a custodian at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, and witnessed crucial events that do not support the official theory, seconded this thought. "We haven't seen anything yet from the government," said Rodriguez. "Conferences such as these help us keep a watchful eye on the rights we've been losing. It's one of the few places where everyday people can still come together and have access to information blacked out by the media." Attendee Carl Ashman agreed, telling American Free Press, "This conference represents a gathering of people who genuinely care about what this country should be. A man that profoundly impacted the direction our nation took during his tenure as a U.S. congressman was AFP columnist Jim Traficant, who received standing ovations both before and after his keynote speech Saturday at the conference. During his presentation, Traficant proclaimed in a booming voice, "Once we reach a time when people fear their government, it's time to replace that government." Traficant also stressed that America's social and cultural demise is not being examined closely enough. "We're building a dependent underclass," Traficant said, "that is causing us to subsidize illegitimacy. At the same time, our tax laws are so big that they'd give Hulk Hogan a hernia." Amid boisterous cheers, Traficant also told the audience, "When I won my House seat in '84, I didn't know anybody a thing. By the time I left, the Department of Justice, IRS, and AIPAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, had made me their number one target." Another presenter, Money Masters filmmaker and author William Still, explained that throughout history, the greatest mission of freedom-seeking people has been an escape from serfdom. Today, the feudal lords who oversee global plutocratic governments pose the greatest danger to patriotic Americans. He advocates an interest-free money system to replace the private, for-profit creation of money, a central means of plutocratic control. Another crowd favorite was Sheriff Richard Mack, who boasted of being ranked number 18 on the Southern Poverty Law Center's SPLC hate list. Mack, author of From My Cold Dead Fingers, Why America Needs Guns, acted as one of the pivotal driving forces in overturning President Bill Clinton's draconian Brady Bill in 1997. More than a decade after this monumental Supreme Court ruling, Mack vows, "I've taken an oath. I will never be on the wrong side again. All of our lawmakers must likewise ask themselves, are we on the side of the people or the side of the tyrants?" Speaking of judicial matters, attorney Brad Davis of the Pacific Justice Institute told the gathering that his lawsuit against universal health care might be the first to reach a Supreme Court. He stressed, "The Supremacy Clause will have no limits if Obamacare wins." The event's MC, Payman Motadeh, may have most fittingly summarized the weekend conference when he told AFP, "We live in a matrix of lies, and only by seeking the truth can we be set free." An annual speaker at this conference, former IRS agent Joe Bannister, described Motadeh as the grand poobah of the militant tax protester movement. His assessment certainly rings true, for Payman revealed the IRS currently holds a 5,600-page dossier on him. It is this type of heavy-handed Big Brother overlord mentality that those who travel to the 2011 Freedom Conference oppose. As Badnarik insisted, "My entire philosophy toward government is contained in seven simple words. Don't hurt me, don't take my stuff." Page 8, AFP's Spotlight on Congress. Obama needs to consider all options to stop violent Mexican drug cartels. A U.S. congressman is calling on the White House to increase the number of Border Patrol agents patrolling the U.S. border with Mexico and to send in the military to assist the Mexican government in shutting down the heavily armed drug cartels that are operating with impunity in that country. The statement by Representative Michael McCaul, Republican Texas, came after two U.S. agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement were shot in their armored SUV with diplomatic plates in broad daylight on heavily trafficked Mexico Highway 57 en route to Mexico City on February 15th. The two were reportedly helping Mexican authorities fight drug trafficking. One officer, Brownsville native Jamie Zapata, 32, was killed in the shootout, while the other, who was shot twice in the leg, survived. The drug cartels changed the rules of the game, McCaul told a Washington, D.C. daily. Traditionally, they would not go after our law enforcement. Our agents told them they were American diplomats, and their response was, "I don't care," and they opened fire with an AK-47. It's a direct attack on the United States, and I think the Obama administration needs to respond in a very forceful way to these dangerous criminal elements. The U.S. Border Patrol has approximately 20,000 agents patrolling America's 1,993-mile-long border with Mexico. Additionally, there are a dozen agents who are authorized to work inside Mexico at any given time investigating drug and human trafficking. U.S. police in Mexico are limited in what they can do. In the case of the February 15th attack, it was a one-sided assault on U.S. law enforcement because Mexican authorities do not allow U.S. agents to carry their weapons while in the country. Mexican police have reportedly arrested two members of a powerful drug gang in Mexico in connection with the attack. But so far, Mexico has refused to extradite the two to stand trial for the killings in a U.S. court and face the death penalty. Typically, Mexico will not extradite if it is for the death penalty, said McCaul. They're morally opposed to it. I think in this case, we need to have them make an exception to that. I would prefer to see them extradited and tried in the United States, where I think they would receive swift justice under the law and have the prosecutors apply for the death penalty. Now, Lieberman, McCain want U.S. to make war on Libya. At the height of the Libyan crisis, with revolutionary groups fighting against President Muammar Gaddafi, Senators John McCain, Republican Arizona, and Joe Lieberman, Independent Connecticut, went on national television to argue that the U.S. government should pick a side, namely the rebels, and give them weapons so they can fight the current Libyan, or perhaps we should say West Libyan, government. The two senior legislators were in Cairo, Egypt, when they spoke to U.S. journalists, claiming to be on a fact-finding mission. Washington speak for a personal junket at a huge cost to taxpayers. This is a real moment of choice for the international community, Lieberman told reporters. Will the world stand by and let a leader like Muammar Gaddafi slaughter his own people? And what would Lieberman, who has never served a day in his life in the military, have the United States do? I think we ought to recognize the opposition provisional government as a legitimate government of Libya, and we ought to give that government certainly humanitarian assistance and military arms, said Lieberman. McCain agreed, proposing that the United States should also send fighter jets to Libya to enforce a no-fly zone over the sovereign country. Libyan pilots aren't going to fly if there is a no-fly zone, and we could get air assets there to ensure it, said McCain. In addition, he added, Washington should recognize the provisional government that they are trying to set already up in the eastern part of Libya and help them with material assistance. Not stopping there, McCain added that the United States should be willing to meddle in every conflict around the world, including the entire Middle East, as well as Iran and China. The president should reverse the terrible decision he made in 2009 to not support the demonstrators in Tehran, said McCain. Stand up for democracy in Iran and tell those people that we are with them. And that should be true not only throughout the Arab countries, but as far as China and other parts of the world as well. Iran is not an Arab country. At a time when America is struggling with overwhelming debt, the idea of spending taxpayers' dollars flying two Washington legislators to the Middle East just to grandstand shows the arrogance and insanity of the imperialistic mentality gripping Washington. The costs are huge for a trip like this. AFP contacted the Congressional Research Service, CRS, to ascertain the price tag for flying the two senators around the Middle East and the security needed to protect them. AFP was told, however, that the information was not immediately available because the travel receipts had not been logged yet. But since CRS only tallies immediate costs billed directly to Congress, the extra expense is seldom publicized as it is quietly dumped on the Pentagon, which usually pays for flying legislators to problem areas of the world and then protecting them with U.S. troops. Since 2001, The Hill, a Capitol Hill daily, estimated the cost of congressional travel to be in the neighborhood of $50 million. The high price would be worth it if these types of trips benefited the taxpayers, the people who pay the bills and bleed in the wars. But it is these delusions of empire voiced by Lieberman and McCain that have placed this once great country in such a dire strait. The policy the United States should adopt was presented clearly by AFP editors in the emergency letter that went out to all our readers during our President's Day publishing break. Be looking in your mailbox for that important emergency update. It stated in part, "We will be blamed for the death and destruction if we don't start a new hands-off the Middle East policy instead of our worn-out Israel first and internationalist mindset." In the letter, we urged readers to immediately contact their representatives in Washington and tell them to adopt this hands-off policy now. People in the Middle East are revolting against corruption and the old policies. They want less meddling on the part of the U.S. and to be free of U.S. and Israeli control. We can no longer afford to be the world's police force. When Washington wakes up to this reality, we may once again find ourselves on the side of peace. Page 10, AFP on International Intrigue. U.S. spy caught red-handed in Pakistan. Global backlash results after U.S. diplomat reveals he's working for the CIA, by Richard Walker. It was like a scene straight out of a James Bond movie, but in this case, the spy is American. He pulls his Glock pistol and fires through the window of a speeding car, killing someone who was tailing him. His car screeches to a halt and he jumps out, taking careful aim at another man who was running away. More shots are fired. Bond finishes him off, too. Two other Americans, armed to the teeth, race to the rescue, speeding through traffic the wrong way in an SUV. They run over an innocent civilian, killing him, when suddenly they find their SUV is about to be hemmed in by police cruisers and an angry crowd. They threaten to shoot people in the crowd and then make their escape. That is the bones of what happened during rush hour in the center of busy Lahore in Pakistan on January 27, 2011. Three Pakistanis were left dead, and the wife of one of the first two committed suicide by eating rat poison upon learning of her husband's untimely violent death. The American shooter was 36-year-old Raymond Davis, who escaped into a bazaar and was arrested before an angry crowd could grab him. The two men driving the SUV dumped it at the American consulate in Lahore and were spirited out of the country within hours. CIA and State Department officials immediately went into damage control mode after the triple homicide. They claimed Davis was a diplomat with immunity. They said he had just been to an ATM to withdraw money and was followed by two armed criminals determined to rob him. He acted in self-defense, they argued, when he killed both of them. No mention, however, was made of the other Americans and their role in the killing of an innocent civilian. The reality, moreover, was far from what U.S. officials were claiming. When several media outlets contacted Davis's wife in the U.S., she gave them a number for his employer, the CIA. Other investigations unearthed that he had been an officer with the Special Forces until 2003, when he joined the notorious contractor Blackwater, now known as XE Services. At some point, the CIA recruited him for its clandestine war against the alleged Pakistani Taliban. When the Obama White House heard some American media outlets had discovered Davis was a spy, it leaned on them not to publish the CIA link. They agreed, but Pakistani intelligence told the international media he was a spy, so word quickly got out. The two men Davis shot dead were in their early 20s and were on a motorcycle tailing him. Five cell phones, several of them stolen, were found on their bodies. It was subsequently reported they were employed by Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, to keep an eye on Davis. It turns out Davis shot the second man five times, including in the back, as the man fled the scene. Then, cool as a cucumber, Davis strolled back to his car and phoned for help before photographing the dead men. He ran from the scene as police and civilians closed in. In his car were the tools of his trade: cash, untraceable mobile phones, an infrared scope, bolt cutters, and a lot of spare handgun ammunition. He also had a digital camera with photos showing he had been checking out people and installations in Lahore and on the Pakistan-Afghan border. His two companions ditched incriminating materials, including bullets for an automatic rifle and pistols, and a blindfold and combat knives as they fled to the U.S. consulate. Pakistanis are furious that the U.S. has been permitted to run a secret war on their soil. The White House and State Department have brought all kinds of pressure to bear on Pakistan's government to release Davis. There has even been talk of Congress stopping the massive financial subsidies paid to Pakistan's military. But the problem for those leaders is that ordinary people in Pakistan are now clamoring for Davis to be tried and executed. They are also angry that the U.S. spirited his two companions out of the country after they killed a civilian. A request by the Lahore authorities to interview the other two spies was denied. The only option is for Davis to admit guilt and for the families of the dead to be compensated. In Pakistan, families will often accept blood money in return for agreeing to drop charges. Much of the anger in Pakistan is derived from the cold, calculated way Davis shot the second victim, and the manner in which the State Department and the White House lied and tried to cover it up. the mythical bond would not have been caught so easily. The episode speaks of a U.S. foreign policy out of control. Page 12, AFP on the Mideast. Attack on reporter exploited by Keith Johnson. A leading authority on the Middle East says a popular U.S. female journalist who was brutally attacked on the streets of Cairo in early February was targeted not by pro-democracy demonstrators, but by former President Hosni Mubarak's thugs, intent on making protesters look like violent criminals in the eyes of the West. On February 11, 2011, in Cairo, throngs of jubilant Egyptians gathered in Tahrir Square to celebrate the resignation of President Hosni Mubarak. Working her way through the crowd that night was CBS chief foreign correspondent Lara Logan, who covered the festivities for an upcoming 60 Minutes segment. But this relatively peaceful setting soon turned ugly for Miss Logan when she found herself surrounded by a dangerous element. According to a CBS press release, it was a mob of more than 200 people whipped into a frenzy. In the crush of the mob, Logan was separated from her crew. Logan was surrounded and suffered a brutal and sustained assault and beating before being saved by a group of women and about 20 Egyptian soldiers. Miss Logan was flown back to the United States within hours of the attack and treated for her injuries. She is currently recovering at her Washington, D.C. home. So far, Miss Logan has declined to make a public statement. On February 24th, this writer consulted Nasheed Abdul Khalik of www.ascertaintruth.com. He is the foremost authority when it comes to dispelling myths about Islam and provided insight into the Arab world. When asked what he thought the real motivations were behind Miss Logan's attack, Nasheed replied, "She wasn't raped, she wasn't even truly sexually attacked. She was, unfortunately, stripped of clothes while being beaten, which indicates extreme contempt. There's no doubt that the woman went through something violent and humiliating. However, the crowd took her for an Israeli journalist or a spy, and she became the target of collective anger and disgust." Nasheed continued, "Rape is more highly prominent in the United States, where Lara Logan is from, than what could be found in Egypt. In fact, it is almost non-existent in the Muslim world. In direct comparison to Egypt, in 1 year, 1 out of every 1 million women are raped in Egypt versus 286 out of every 1 million women are raped in the United States." As soon as the Logan story broke, Zionist media assets in the United States made a hurried and concerted effort to blame the attacks on pro-democracy Egyptian demonstrators, deliberately ignoring the evidence that almost conclusively proves otherwise. Israel is determined to keep Egypt from falling to civilian governance. For 30 years, Mubarak had proven to be a valuable asset to the Israelis. He complied with Israel's blockade against the Palestinians by sealing the border with Gaza, and was one of only two other Arab leaders to recognize the 1979 peace treaty. As the second largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid, Egypt regularly trained with the U.S. and Israeli militaries, developing an intimate strategic relationship. With Mubarak gone, Israel's only chance to maintain that relationship is to ensure that Mubarak's remaining military junta continues to wield a significant influence over political affairs. That is why the civilian uprising must be discredited. The Logan attack provided an opportunity to portray Egyptian society as an unruly population of women-hating savages that can only be contained by force. Miss Logan's perpetrators were actually pro-Mubarak thugs sent into the streets that night to discredit the Egyptian freedom movement and disrupt the otherwise peaceful celebrations. Earlier in the month, Mubarak recognized that media coverage of the uprisings was garnering international support and emboldening the demonstrators. To counter these images, Mubarak dressed police officers in plain clothes and grouped them with paid thugs to harass journalists, a false flag mini-operation. Then, according to the Arabic news network Al Jazeera, Mubarak used Egyptian state television to foment the unrest by reporting that Israeli spies had infiltrated the city, which explains why many of the gangs who attacked reporters shouted Yahudi or Jew. Although Mubarak is a loyal Israeli stooge, he knows when to play the Israeli card to stir up tensions. While Egyptians may be divided for or against their own government, they almost unanimously stand against the State of Israel for its persecution of fellow Muslims and Christians in neighboring Gaza. Mubarak's media broadcasts were not intended to incite the peaceful protests. Instead, they were directed at his loyalists. Somali Pirates Continue Unchallenged Terror Campaign by Victor Thorne. With 4 U.S. missionaries recently slain, over 50 hijacked vessels still being held captive, and nearly 1,000 hostages languishing under the control of Somali pirates, a major question remains unanswered. Where is Barack Obama, the UN, or many other international governing bodies that supposedly keep our world safe? Why are high seas savages allowed to continually terrorize the Horn of Africa with little or no consequence? Adding insult to injury, why hasn't our president offered any meaningful reaction after four noble, Bible-distributing Americans were slaughtered after being hijacked by pirates? On February 22nd, Adam Nagorny and Jeffrey Gettleman of the New York Times described the murders of Gene and Scott Adam, along with their two sailing companions, as one of the most violent episodes since the modern-day piracy epidemic began several years ago. According to U.S. Navy Vice Admiral Mark Fox, 19 Somali pirates stormed the Adams yacht, the Quest, and deliberately fired an RPG-7 rocket-propelled grenade at the naval vessel USS Sterrett. Almost immediately thereafter, Fox explained how gunfire erupted on the Quest as a Navy SEALs team rushed the yacht. Though many of the pirates surrendered, special ops officers shot one Somali while stabbing to death another in hand-to-hand combat. By this point, regrettably, the captives were already dead. However, a different version of this harrowing event has emerged. A U.S. naval armada, including an aircraft carrier, monitored the Quest for 3 days following its capture by Somalis. During this tense situation, two pirates boarded the Sterrett to negotiate with FBI agents. But for whatever reason, an agreement couldn't be reached. David Usborne of the UK Independent described these unsuccessful talks in a February 25th article. The FBI negotiator on board the U.S. warship decided he could not take the pirates' leader seriously, Usborne wrote. So in retaliation, the Somalis fired a grenade at the Sterrett, causing SEALs to frantically intervene. A pirate only identified as Ali told Agence France-Presse on February 24th, "We got information that the American hostages were killed after the U.S. Navy stormed the yacht. They tried to rescue the hostages, but unfortunately heavy gunfire was exchanged, and the hostages, died as a result," Ali recalled. Whether pirates intentionally murdered their elderly American hostages or they died as a result of a failed rescue attempt, one fact remains. Passageways near the Gulf of Aden are the most dangerous waters in the world, and President Obama refuses to do anything. Page 14, Will Libyan Slaughter Be Catalyst for Freedom? By Frank Whalen. Called a bloodbath and a massacre of protesters, Libya's rebellion against Muammar Gaddafi's regime is yet another example of people seeking freedom over tyranny, a trend that doesn't appear to be stopping anytime soon. From uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, where both countries have removed their presidents, the bloody events in Libya may achieve the same goal. Recently, more than 7,000 refugees from Libya crossed the border into Tunisia, where they were welcomed with a spirit of Arab unity. Human Rights Watch reported 300 deaths in 10 days, but Italian Foreign Minister Franco Frattini called reports of about 1,000 fatalities a credible account. As pro-Gaddafi forces seek to enforce his rule, word of their tactics is spreading from the refugees. Hired foreign mercenaries are randomly shooting people on sight, even using anti-aircraft guns to wipe out crowds of protesters. Eyewitnesses claim that the police, while initially trying to suppress the demonstrators, eventually joined them in opposition to these atrocities. Libyan forces are searching refugees near bordering countries, confiscating digital memory cards, to prevent photographs and or video evidence about the slaughters from emerging. Another indication of modern communications power is reports of text messages and Facebook being used to organize rallies or collect food and supplies for the exiled. Libya's attempt to cut off internet and cellular access are failing to silence the masses. Many of these efforts were futile in Egypt also. China is now trying to tighten its internet stranglehold as Chinese citizens use so-called social networking websites like Facebook and Twitter to call for similar protests. Thousands are similarly rising against the de facto Iraqi government, outrage that merely expressing displeasure with their leaders earns them a terrorist label. The Wall Street Journal says that Libya possesses chemical weapons, ballistic missiles, conventional weapons, as well as 1,000 metric tons of uranium yellowcake. Are these figures legitimate, or are they reminiscent of previous false flag WMD alarms like that in Iraq with Saddam Hussein? Such fear-mongering could undoubtedly result in stronger anti-terrorism legislation. While purportedly being used to keep innocents safe, these laws seem more likely a method to keep other populations from turning against their own governments. In January, Iran's Press TV interviewed former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who spoke of the fear of uprisings sweeping the Middle East. He suggested that former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak might have even appealed to Israel for help. Tel Aviv is worried that movement in Egypt could be contagious enough to spread to Israel's neighboring countries, McGovern surmised. It seems that even disparate governments have a common fear of the people organizing and rising against them. Palestinians are one of the most oppressed people in the world, and their Israeli oppressors are surely going to have to increase their oppressive tactics. As would be expected, many corrupt leaders are nervous, and longing for liberty is sweeping much of the Middle East. Even U.S. officials who claim to represent a shining light of civil liberties to the world are bound to wonder how long their own people will continue to comply with a creeping police state. Speculation, not unrest, forces prices up, by Christopher J. Petherick. Don't believe the mainstream media that the rising price of crude oil is largely a result of Middle East unrest. Commodity prices are up across the board thanks to rampant speculation in the market, which is due to recent policies instituted by the privately owned and controlled Federal Reserve. In early December 2010, several economists expressed concerns that the Fed's new plan to flood the market with dollars by buying up debt, known as Quantitative Easing 2, QE2, would force commodity prices up. It seems economists' predictions now are ringing true. Quantitative easing enables the Fed to increase liquidity by buying up bonds for the purpose of increasing their prices and lowering long-term interest rates. It's a blunt instrument that central bankers use to keep the money flowing during hard economic times. When Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke announced QE2, U.S. policymakers liked the idea, believing bankers would take this money and loan it at low interest rates to small businesses and consumers. However, that is not happening. Wall Street has been investing all this new money in commodities, long considered a safe bet during tough economic times. The problem, of course, is that Wall Street is again making huge profits at the expense of Main Street. Increased trading in these markets has created another bubble that is driving up the price of crude oil, gold, silver, wheat, and corn. It doesn't stop there. The spiraling cost of raw materials and energy is now forcing companies to raise their prices too, which are then passed on to consumers. So, once again, everyday Americans are taking it on the chin, thanks to the Federal Reserve and Wall Street's culture of greed. Page 14, AFP on the war in Afghanistan. Man who exposed PSYOP on congressman targeted, by Victor Thorne. Another top U.S. general has been disgraced in a manner that directly reflects America's unnecessary no-win war against Afghanistan. Incomprehensibly, Lieutenant General William Caldwell sanctioned the use of psychological operations, or PSYOPs, to manipulate senators such as John McCain, Joseph Lieberman, Carl Levin, and Al Franken during trips to the battlefield in order to secure more support and taxpayer dollars for the ongoing war effort there. Further, Caldwell devoted an entire military cell to mine scores of personal files on these legislators. His information operatives, I.O., would then use different psychological tactics to influence their visitors into directing more funds toward the Afghan war machine. The man slated to direct this I.O. campaign was Lieutenant Colonel Michael Holmes, who stated his objectives to Michael Hastings in the February 23rd issue of Rolling Stone. My job in PSYOPs is to play with people's heads, to get the enemy to behave the way we want them to behave, Holmes admitted. However, in this instance, the enemy was an entourage of elected U.S. officials. Holmes said he ultimately rebelled against his superiors, who overtly violated federal laws such as the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 that prohibits using PSYOPs against American citizens. To silence Holmes, Caldwell ordered his chief of staff to launch a probe against the whistleblower that could potentially torpedo his career. Soon, Holmes faced charges of alcohol abuse, inappropriate relationships, and using Facebook too much. Still, the colonel didn't back down, citing how Caldwell wanted him to plant ideas into the heads of visiting dignitaries without their knowledge. For their part, General David Petraeus and Defense Secretary Robert Gates have authorized investigations into the alleged PSYOP scandal and into the ensuing cover-up. Rolling Stone journalist Michael Hastings summarized the sorry state of affairs surrounding this foreign entanglement. The incident, wrote Hastings, offers an indication of just how desperate the U.S. command in Afghanistan is to spin American civilian leaders into supporting an increasingly unpopular war. Ambassador says U.S. will be in Afghanistan a long time. Washington, D.C. During a February 9th gathering at the National Press Club, former U.S. Ambassador Anne Wright spoke passionately about the Afghan people's growing desire and overtures for peace, even while U.S. forces continue to rain destruction upon them and operate as if the military occupation is permanent. Civilians are in a precarious position. They are being shot and killed with impunity, Ms. Wright said. We know the drone intel is not good, Ms. Wright stated, heavily adding, all too frequently it, the intended target, was the wrong person. We are killing incredible numbers of Afghan civilians. The dinner speech in the famous Sarah McClendon Room was covered exclusively by American Free Press to learn more about the military's real intentions in this 10th year of occupying Afghanistan. Ms. Wright, herself a retired Army colonel, was in the Foreign Service for 16 years. She was last assigned as ambassador to Mongolia. She resigned the very day that U.S. forces launched the shock and awe bombing run against Baghdad, Iraq, in March 2003. She and two others resigned, thinking at the time that the Bush administration's claims of Iraq possessing menacing weapons of mass destruction were a little bit flaky. Counting 40,000 NATO personnel, 60,000 U.S. contractors, 300,000 U.S.-trained Afghan military and police, and 100,000 U.S. troops, there are 500,000 people in Afghanistan whose sole purpose is to provide security, Ms. Wright said. Having made two trips to Afghanistan in the fall of 2009 and December 2010, she noted that versus those 500,000 are perhaps 15,000 so-called insurgents, if you count each and every opponent of the U.S.-led occupation, from whatever village or background. Civilian casualties skyrocketing. The number of Afghanistan's civilian casualties is geometrically progressing. They doubled from last year, she said, predicting the number will keep skyrocketing. A special Oxfam International report, Nowhere to Turn, The Failure to Protect Civilians in Afghanistan, documents the situation. It's posted at oxfam.org. U.S. military bases, counting the smallest outposts, number more than 400 in Afghanistan, but many are quite large. In the capital city, Kabul, and in two other locations, there are huge megabases. Hundreds of millions of dollars, Ms. Wright said, are being spent on these compounds to protect our military from the enemy. Such expenditures are not just for providing troops with shelter over the next year or so. They are going to be there a long time, she stated. A new embassy will even surpass the palatial U.S. facility in Baghdad. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul will be the largest in the world, with this year's $500 million expansion plus $50 million consulates in Herat and Mazar-e-Sharif, Ms. Wright later told AFP. Ms. Wright was in Kabul when the U.S. announced troop reductions, but her sources tell her a different story, indicating a long troop presence. But why occupy Afghanistan? One reason, she surmised, may be to establish a lasting hedge against China, among other motives that include vast profits. Ms. Wright spoke of an Afghanistan defense minister who is a Harvard graduate with a multi-million dollar contract that includes security services. It's well documented we're paying off a lot of people, she said. Ms. Wright is working with a group called the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, which consists of kids, ages 13 to 20, who, whenever possible, use computer technology to network with activists around the world. More information about the group can be found on its website at www.ourjourneytosmile.com. Palestine likened to Afghanistan. We are Afghans. We want the people to listen. Stop your night raids, please, Ms. Wright stated, emotionally reading one of the group's statements, which also noted, how can we survive without the hope that maybe there is something better? These Afghan kids have also expressed solidarity for Palestinian kids being injured, orphaned, and killed by Israeli troops in the Gaza Strip, where half of the 1.5 million who live in Gaza are under the age of 15. A Gaza youth peace group also is active. Ms. Wright also spoke of the plight of Palestinians. There is no one holding them, the Israelis, accountable for what they're doing, she said. Ms. Wright, who was aboard one of the ships in the Gaza relief flotilla attacked by Israeli commandos in mid-2010, announced to the press club audience, "We are going to have a second flotilla. It may have 22 ships." Page 16, AFP profiles possible candidates. Will another Bush run in 2012? By Keith Hansen. Although the 2012 presidential election is 21 months away, posturing and positioning has already begun to determine the degree of enthusiasm any possible candidate might generate. This early field testing includes murmurs of a three- or four-party race and open talk about what many have thought about, but none has dared to mention, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush as a presidential candidate. As if the two Georges weren't enough, coming from a family with a father and son team of Skull and Bones graduates, a pro-war secret society at Yale. Which party Jeb chooses remains the biggest variable. More than likely, it will be the mainstream GOP. But it could also be a third party currently drawing support from independently minded people. Don't forget that fellow Floridian Charlie Crist, another former Republican governor of Florida, tried to run as an independent for the Senate seat that was being vacated by Mel Martinez. Crist may have lost to Marco Rubio, but the precedent was set nonetheless. Some say it's unlikely that the Tea Party movement will adopt another Bush family member. But many established Tea Party groups are nothing more than Republican front groups acting as steam valves for disillusioned conservatives. Even now, nearly 90% of Tea Party activists are less than thrilled by what passes for traditional Republicans. If nothing else, it would be quite a spectacle having perhaps four parties competing for the presidency, a situation that harks back to three separate elections that occurred a century ago. In 1860, four candidates ran, with Abraham Lincoln emerging as the winner. In 1872, the overcrowded field led to an even more bizarre race. incumbent and eventual winner, Ulysses S. Grant, was challenged by 7 candidates, the most formidable of whom, liberal Republican newspaperman Horace Greeley, died before the casting of his 66 electoral votes. The 1912 election was the last in which 4 substantial candidates competed. Democrat Woodrow Wilson defeated incumbent Republican William Howard Taft, the only time an incumbent was unseated in a multiple-candidate race. Adding to the ignominy of his defeat, Taft finished 3rd behind Wilson and progressive candidate Teddy Roosevelt, who received 88 electoral votes to Taft's paltry 8. Socialist candidate Eugene Debs finished last, the 4th of 5 losses he sustained in races he entered between 1900 and 1920. Enter Jeb Bush. Is he a candidate any party could accept? Recently, he has been written about quite extensively as a strong, perhaps the strongest, challenger to Obama. Back in 2007, plenty of Floridians wanted Jeb, after he completed his 2nd gubernatorial term, to go straight from Tallahassee to the White House, taking hold of the scepter from older brother George W. and continuing the Bush dynastic line. At that time, Jeb, in an appreciative tone, turned away such presidential notions. Today, he still demurely replies in the negative when asked if he would run in 2012. Whether or not he's playing hard to get, his polite refusals only make him that much more endearing to those who are looking for another Bush in the White House. Even if he is sincere about not wishing to run in 2012, he might finally see the light of opportunity in next year's election. To many Republicans, Jeb's reign as Florida governor was respectable. He is viewed, because of his gubernatorial work, as being strong in education. He is also articulate, far more so than his father and older brother, in a Clinton-esque sort of way. His wife, Columba, is Mexican-born, and Jeb is fluent in Spanish, thus beneficial in courting the growing Latino and Cuban vote. This is especially important to many internationalist Republicans who are willing to reach out to anyone in order to grab more power. He has the backing of the powerful and well-funded pro-Israel neoconservatives. Jeb was in the pro-war Project for a New American Century, PNAC, gang even before his governor days. He was one of the top-line signatories to PNAC's Statement of Principles, along with notorious neoconservatives Elliot Abrams, Gary Bauer, and William J. Bennett. Finally, let's not forget he's got that bloodline going for him. So, though Jeb doth protest much, will he run in 2012 or provide leadership to traditional Republicans who refuse to embrace dissatisfied Tea Party splinter groups? Page 17, AFP on the U.S. Military. You Can't Run from Army's Smart Gun, by Evan Anderson. From super strong liquid body armor that resists most ammo to smart ballistics, the American military keeps developing newer and more creative ways to enhance the perpetual war-killing machine. The Army's latest shiny new toy is the XM-25, counter-defilade target engagement system, developed by Heckler & Koch, a German company with 3 U.S. affiliates. The weapon's full name is slightly misleading since it makes the weapon sound large, but it's just a sophisticated grenade launcher with a price tag of $35,000. But what it does is apparently worth that much to the adventuresome U.S. military since taxpayers foot the bill. Say an enemy insurgent is hiding behind a wall. The gun's laser rangefinder tells you how far away the insurgent is, then you push a button to adjust for the estimated distance and pull the trigger. The emerging round flies in front of or above the target and blasts the poor soul with shrapnel. The weapon uses 25mm smart grenades that each cost about $24. They contain special chips which receive a radio signal from the weapon's sight telling it how far it has traveled, effectively eliminating taking cover in trenches, around corners, or anywhere else as a responsive tactic. The enemy's grim options are to either die or keep running. And with a range of about 2,300 feet, he won't get too far. In the summer of 2010, the U.S. Army began field testing the XM-25 in Afghanistan, and at some point this year will buy and deploy at least 12,500 of them at a cost of $437 million, enough for one in each infantry squad and special forces team. Lieutenant Colonel Chris Lennert recently told Fox News, "This is a game changer. No longer can the enemy shoot at American forces and hide behind something," Brigadier General Peter Fuller told Army Times. Page 18, AFP on the medical industrial complex. Supreme Court says parents can't sue vaccine makers, by Pat Shannon. The United States Supreme Court ruled 6-2 in February that drug manufacturers cannot be sued by families whose children suffered seizures or worse from routine vaccinations, saying that a 1986 law set up a special compensation fund for such injuries and barred all design defect lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. Once again, what big business wants, big business gets. An ironic twist in what could have been a pivotal case is that the High Court's pro-life conservatives came down on the side of Big Pharma and against assuring better vaccine safety, while the court's best-known liberals, often lambasted for being indifferent to the sanctity of life, sided with the plaintiffs and public safety. Lawyers representing families whose children have suffered debilitating effects from poison masquerading as healthy inoculations said the ruling does nothing to motivate manufacturers to make safer vaccines. The case was originally brought by Russell and Robley Brusewitz in Pennsylvania against the Wyeth Drug Company, which is now owned by the Pfizer drug giant. The couple took action after their six-month-old daughter, Hannah, began suffering seizures in 1992. She had been injected with a Wyeth-made vaccine purported to immunize against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, the well-known DPT shot. Hannah is now 19 and has been developmentally impaired her whole life. The federal courts at the district and appellate levels had dismissed the case, ruling that the family had failed to prove the seizures were caused by the DPT vaccine. The section of the law that raised the greatest dispute in the Brusewitz case says that no vaccine manufacturer shall be held liable in a civil action for any injury that resulted from side effects that were unavoidable. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia and the majority believe that this could not allow any design defect claims. Scalia wrote that the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was intended to protect against injuries, yet stabilize an industry racked by vaccine-related litigation, providing a balance between compensation for children's injuries and protection for drug makers from litigation. Lobbying with the government to urge the court to bar such lawsuits was the American Academy of Pediatrics, a supposed champion of children, which said, "The decision will enhance the national immunization system and ensure that vaccines will continue to prevent the spread of infectious diseases in this country." Joining Scalia in the majority count were Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Anthony Kennedy, Clarence Thomas, Stephen Breyer, and Samuel Alito. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote the dissenting opinion, joined by fellow liberal Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Sotomayor noted that the Vaccine Act did not clearly block lawsuits for design defect. They said drug makers had long been subject to litigation and the duty to improve the designs of their vaccines. They added that the vaccine injury law does not clearly override state law claims such as that brought by Hannah Brusewitz's parents. Because the U.S. government sided with Wyeth, Elena Kagan, the newest Supreme Court justice, and a former solicitor general, sat out this dispute. Washington lawyer David Frederick, representing the plaintiffs, said the decision removes any incentive for drug makers to comport with the most recent scientific advances in designing safer vaccines. The highly profitable vaccine industry has grown wildly over the decades, with children subjected to far more types of vaccines with unknown testing procedures than ever before. The DPT shot is one of the more traditional vaccines, while newer ones venture into immunizing the body against a host of other afflictions for which immunizations typically are not needed. See much more on the vaccine racket in AFP's Whole Body Health and Preparedness supplement accompanying this edition. Page 19, AFP on Freedom of Speech, Free Speech Stifled on Israeli Crimes, by James P. Tucker, Jr. The mainstream media, often allergic to facts, has denounced former President Jimmy Carter for speaking the truth about Israel and the Palestinians. Although taxes and deficits grew and Iran's seizure of U.S. hostages was mishandled on Carter's watch, he has emerged as a voice of reason and diplomacy. When Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, surfaced, Israel's apologists decided there is no free speech under the First Amendment and sued for $5 million. According to attorney Nitzana Darsan-Leitner, the suit claims that Carter has an agenda of anti-Israel propaganda and condemns the publisher for advertising the book as a work of nonfiction. It said Carter has a right to publish a book to put forward his virulent anti-Israel bias, but insisted it should be sold as a fictional work. However, Simon & Schuster spokesman Adam Rothberg called the suit a chilling attack on free speech and said the publisher would fight it in court. Darsan Leitner's lawsuit would have a much better chance in Europe, where there is no First Amendment. thought crimes are common there, but in the United States, under Anglo-Saxon common law, the courts are understood to have no remedy for hurt feelings. At the same time, veteran journalist Helen Thomas got Zionists' knickers in a knot by saying on CNN that after World War II ended, Jews didn't have to go anywhere, really, because they weren't being persecuted anymore, but they were taking other people's land. Earlier, she told a rabbi blogger that Jews should get the hell out of Palestine and go back to Poland, Germany, etc. For this, she was fired by the Hearst newspaper group. She had been a senior writer, the one who ended White House press conferences with the traditional, "Thank you, Mr. President." Undaunted, she now writes for a local newspaper. Jimmy Carter's Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, hardcover, 270 pages, $19 plus $3 shipping and handling, is available from AFP's First Amendment Books. See the handy coupon on page 20 of this week's issue for ordering information. Page 21, Tough Talk from Jim Traficant. Solution to Fiscal Problems Proposed Back in 1999 by Jim Traficant. The Republicans' new majority has pledged, they say, to cut $100 billion. I hope they are not yanking our chain. The Republicans promised to kill the new health care bill and to make massive cuts in the Democrats' new socialist spending spree. Those snide Republicans use this rhetoric to gain the votes of a frustrated electorate and to seduce the support of well-meaning Tea Party activists who want less government and less taxation. Republicans can say they lived up to their promises to a degree. House Republicans did vote to repeal the massive health bill, which sounds good on the surface, but don't bet your rubber ducky on it. Here's how major party politics really work, folks. The Republicans now hold a House majority. The Democrats still hold a Senate majority. President Obama controls the veto pen. The Republicans could have promised anything to the electorate. It was an easy thing to do. However, the Republicans can't do a single thing. Senate Democrats will not allow anything that they do not want, nor that the president does not want. So all these headline-making maneuvers by the House Republicans are just gamesmanship. Do you really think the Senate will fully repeal the health bill? No way. Will Senate Democrats allow the Republicans to become the champion of cuts? In my view, you can bet your bottom dollar that the Democrats will upstage the Republicans by cutting $150 billion or more. You see, folks, there is a keeping the majority ploy in major party politics. And for the Democrats, it's actually easy to do. Let's look at this proposed $100 billion in cuts, or even cuts of $150 billion. The annual budget deficit projected for next fiscal year is more than $1,000 billion, folks. Don't try to do the math. If the Republicans' $100 billion in cuts actually happened, that would only leave an annual one-year budget deficit of, again, only $900 billion. Wow. But the Democrats are really going to win your admiration. They may offer a $150 billion cut initiative. Republicans would be compelled to support it. The Democrats would win the game. Yet, even with a $150 billion reduction, the annual budget deficit would become a mere $850 billion. Beam me up. Meanwhile, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke is suggesting another stimulus package. The chairman is just suggesting at this point. I predict Bernanke will ask for another $1 trillion stimulus package. Another $1,000 billion of new debt put right on your backs, on your savings account, on your mortgages, on your pensions, and on your future financial reckoning. One more thing, this new unsustainable massive debt package will be put right on your job as well. Yes, your job. Will you see more tax cuts? Maybe some tax increases? You may get both. Larry, Moe, and Curly must be advising our legislators. The tax code and the federal income tax must be abolished. But those who want no taxes or import tariffs by themselves need to understand our country will surely implode in that arrangement. I believe everyone must pay the band, every single American of age. That can only be done with a consumption tax. America is no longer a managed debt economy nation. Rather, it's a non-sustainable managed debt economy nation. America should enact the Towson, Traficant, Schaefer consumption tax, a proposal which goes back to 1999, and repeal the never-ratified 16th Amendment to guarantee that the income tax turkey never flies again, while abolishing the IRS. Get back at me. Page 22, The Ryan Report from Vince Ryan. States can use nullification to fight federal meddling by Vince Ryan. It is time for Arizona to nullify federal immigration laws that are patently unconstitutional and deny Arizona the ability to secure its borders. Bonafide immigrants who seek to go through the regular immigration process for citizenship should be welcomed. But the law must be enforced against those who come here illegally to uphold U.S. sovereignty. We would do well to look to nullification, a constitutional theory that gives individual states the right to declare null and void any law passed by the United States Congress, which any state deems unacceptable and unconstitutional. This tool is badly needed concerning a number of problems. John C. Calhoun was a leading Southern statesman in the nullification fight. On July 26, 1831, Calhoun, as Vice President of the United States, defended nullification in his noted Fort Hill Address. This right of interposition, thus solemnly asserted by the state of Virginia, I conceive to be the fundamental principle of our system, resting on facts historically as certain as our revolution itself, and deductions as simple as that of any political or moral truth whatever, and I firmly believe that on its recognition depend the stability and safety of our political institutions. There was a time when anyone born in the U.S. was automatically a citizen, despite the fact that their parents had become citizens only after emigrating here, studying English in our country's history, passing an examination, and taking an oath of allegiance. According to the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Notably, Arizona, a state that has serious border security problems, including the depredations of criminal gangs and drug smugglers from Mexico, is the subject of a New York Times opinion piece, Angry Arizona, again. The super-liberal Times decried an omnibus bill in the Arizona Senate, which included a bill to chop up the 14th Amendment to deny citizenship to children born in Arizona to undocumented mothers, a bill requiring hospitals to check every patient's citizenship status, turning doctors and nurses into immigration police, a bill to deny education to undocumented children by requiring proof of citizenship to enroll in any public or private school, a bill to criminalize driving by illegal immigrants and to evict them from public housing. This will fix nothing and do real harm, bleated the Times. Proponents of birthright citizenship agree that the 14th Amendment guarantees citizenship to all born here, but legislation in the Arizona Senate, authored by Senator Ron Gould, Republican, would require two birth certificates, one for children whose parents are citizens or permanent legal residents, and a different one for those who cannot provide such proof. The legislation ultimately aims to force the U.S. Supreme Court to decide who is and who is not entitled to citizenship by virtue of their place of birth, but that decision likely won't come soon. Arizona State Senate may be wasting its time waiting for the Supreme Court to act. The High Court will probably come down hard on Arizona for not tending to the problems with the Arizona-Mexico border. Nullification of federal intervention in immigration matters is the better option. The big club in the closet waiting to be wielded by the states when they become sufficiently fed up with harmful federal meddling. Proposals similar to Arizona's defining who would get automatic citizenship have been introduced by lawmakers in Indiana, Mississippi, Texas, Oklahoma, and South Dakota. Backers expect another dozen states to follow suit this year. How to resist federal tyranny. Nullification. Author Thomas E. Woods, Jr. provides an eloquent defense of the politically divisive subject of nullification, a remedy used by states against unconstitutional federal power grabs. Every state official should read this book. Hardcover, 306 pages, $25, available from TBR, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C., 20003. Add $5 shipping and handling in the United States. The big picture from Mark Anderson. Swiss voters have the power to nullify unwanted laws, by Mark Anderson. In the acclaimed movie The Third Man, a fugitive played by Orson Welles tells an old friend that the world is sinking under the weight of five-year plans drawn up by communists and their Western capitalist enemies. However, he adds, in Switzerland they have brotherly love and 500 years of democracy and peace. The Swiss do possess much of what Americans wish for but are not allowed to obtain. Having discovered on a recent Swiss trip the journal Current Concerns that explains the Confederation's unique and enduring structure, the matter can be summed as follows. Americans think they're free, but in most respects they are not, while locked in a spy warfare state and shut out of the decision-making process. We see this disconnect when we write to our representatives. The Swiss system institutionalizes peace, neutrality, and cooperation, domestically and externally. Accordingly, it presupposes the need for and maintains a direct democracy component that gives the Swiss people a uniquely large share of the responsibility of making decisions. The Swiss vote more often on ballot proposals than they do electing those politely called representatives. That is as it should be. Merely electing people to office clearly does not make them accountable. American representatives, once elected, are disconnected from the people by a corporate press that withholds steady job performance reports in the form of published legislative voting records. That glaring omission is reinforced by ballot access laws, which hurt other parties by complicating and limiting their ballot access so Democrats and Republicans can monopolize the ballot, media discussion, and campaign funds. This herds everyone and their money under the big tents of these two parties. Switzerland has 12 political parties, and because the Swiss do not elect a president, they avoid the presidential personality cult that engulfs America. Instead, Swiss legislators name a 7-member federal council. Counselors each serve 1 year as president with weak authority. At least 5 of the 12 parties are represented in the federal council, so power sharing that Americans struggle for takes place automatically in Switzerland. With power shifted away from the presidency, the Swiss people take part as an extended legislature by petitioning for ballot proposals to bring about new laws and constitutional changes and nullify those laws deemed outdated, destructive, or otherwise undesirable. In the U.S., the people are disempowered because authority rests in an arrogant executive branch, which makes deals with the legislature. The corporations and their lobbyists are the real constituents of Congress. Meanwhile, the American people helplessly look on if they can take their nose off the grindstone long enough to look. Their assignment is to pay the bondholders so the private bankers with their interest stream kept intact can keep ruling America. Americans would do well to learn from the Swiss and try instituting nullification and a stronger 10th Amendment emphasis to give the states more autonomy from central rule. From there, more decisions besides who to elect to office should be put before U.S. voters.